Pat McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So a common complaint of the modern age is this sense of distraction and lack of focus that pervades our lives. And we typically blame technology like the internet or our smartphones for inability to concentrate on the task at hand. But my guest today argues that the culture of distraction we face today runs much deeper than that and actually began several hundred years ago with the Enlightenment. His name is Matthew Crawford. He's the author of the book Shop Class as Soulcraft. And his latest book is called The World Beyond Your Head, on Becoming a Human in the Age of Distraction. And today on the show, Matthew and I discuss the origins of our distracted culture and the deeper implications of our lives lived totally inside our own heads. And we explore the idea that if we really want to live a life of focus, we need to go beyond just blocking time-wasting sites on our computers and phones. Are you ready to take that journey and discover the world outside your head? Stay tuned for a great discussion. And after the show, make sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/Crawford. All right, Matthew Crawford, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So I've long been a fan of your work. Your first book that I really enjoyed, Shop Class as Soulcraft. Your latest book, The World Beyond Your Head, on Becoming an Individual in an Age of Distraction, is out in paperback now, and it's very, very good. And we're going to talk about that today. But before we get there, can you talk a little bit about your background? Because I think it's interesting first, but also it will put, I think, put some context in from like where you're coming from with the arguments you're making today.
Well, the I tell a little bit of my story in Shop Classes, Soulcraft. I majored in physics as an undergrad in at Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, and tried to get a job with that degree and couldn't, so I fell back on being an electrician and did that for a while. And then eventually I got interested in philosophy. I went and did a PhD in sort of the history of political thought at the University of Chicago, and held various white collar jobs that weren't doing it for me, and found myself running a think tank in DC, and really pretty much hated it. And so I lasted about 5 months. I quit that to open a motorcycle repair shop in Richmond, Virginia.
And yeah, and then from there, I mean, that's what you do, but you're also right now, I guess currently it says on your back of your book, you're a senior fellow at the University of Virginia.
Yeah, right. So I don't teach, but I've got this gig as a research fellow at the University of Virginia. So what it means is that I try to get out there about once a week and have lovely conversations with people. It's a really nice intellectual community. So it's kind of just enough of a toehold in academia to give me what I need from that kind of environment.
Gotcha.
But there's no obligation. So I think there must be some clerical error at the heart of it, but I don't ask too many questions.
Right. So you spend most of your time working in your motorcycle shop.
Yeah, it varies because I should back up. I also do some writing, obviously. So
right.
Depending on how much writing. So like these days, it's probably like 30 hours a week in the shop. And that goes sort of up and down. I've got an employee right now, so I kind of have to be there more.
Gotcha. So your first book, Shop Class as Soulcraft, you make the case that skilled manual labor can provide a person a sense of satisfaction and meaning that can't be found in the world of knowledge work or information work, right? I mean, you felt it, and I think a lot of other people felt it. It's like, the work I'm doing, I don't really know what it's doing, actually pushing in numbers into Excel sheets. And it's a really great book. For our listeners who haven't read it, go out there and get it. Your new book, The World Beyond Your Head, on Becoming an Individual in an Age of Distraction. Is this book a continuation of your thoughts in Shop Class? And if so, how are the two connected?
Well, I guess one really simple way to state the connection would be they're motivated by the kind of being struck with the thought that various forms of slavery come wrapped in an ideology of freedom. So, in Shop Class, I was trying to make sense of my own work experience and why I always felt so stultified and sleepy, really, in the various cubicle jobs I'd had. You know, when you're working in an office, it's often difficult to say exactly what you've accomplished at the end of any given day. The chain of cause and effect can be pretty opaque and confusing. And so that feeling of individual agency can be elusive. And by that, I just mean, you know, seeing a direct effect of your actions in the world. Whereas, you know, I've worked as a mechanic and electrician, and, you know, when I flip the switch and see the lights come on, it's like it's this incontrovertible experience of having done something that I can actually point to. And I always found that really kind of thrilling.
And then the connection, so in the world beyond your head.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then in the world beyond your head, it's this sense that we're living through a sort of crisis of attention right now. And it's become pretty widely remarked upon. It's usually people complaining about technology in some way. I think one reason it's become hard for us to resist all the enticements and all the sort of appropriations of our attention is that they kind of presented to us under the under an ideology of choice, right? Just having more choices is always better. And this idea that we get really from economics, that to maximize your freedom requires maximizing the number of choices you face. But that's precisely the condition that makes for maximum dissipation of your energies. So it seemed like it required a reflection on kind of what's at stake when we're so kind of subject to appropriation of our attention by often mechanized forces and by commercial forces. Because when it's really bad, I think it often feels like what's at stake is whether you're going to be able to maintain a coherent self, you know, just a self that's able to act according to settled purposes and ongoing projects rather than just flitting about.
Right. And besides, I mean, you kind of touched on that a bit. I mean, some of the consequences of this attentional problem that we're facing today. But I mean, it seems like in the book, it runs deeper, or the argument that you're making is it runs deeper than just being like, oh man, like I got to quit checking Facebook because I got to be productive in my job or whatever. It seems like the consequences actually are deeper and affect us on a societal level as well. So what are some of those consequences?
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, a kind of a feeling of fragmentation, the feeling that your attention isn't simply yours to direct as you will. Now, of course, it's not, you know, as simple as some kind of, you know, it's not something coercive. It's tapping into appetites we have for certain kinds of stimulation. You know, we willingly invite into our lives all these things from Candy Crush to porn. And so I think really this distractibility points to a deeper cultural problem, which is kind of agnosticism about what's worth paying attention to. And that really comes down to the question of what to value, because what you pay attention to is sort of what's most present to you or most real for you. And I think part of the problem is that just the way we inhabit the world is really changed dramatically over the past, I don't know, 20 years or something. I mean, you could trace the kind of genealogy of this variously and push it back 100 years if you want. But in any case, when sort of the natural way of inhabiting the world is just in your body. And the body gives us a kind of center of orientation. So there's things behind me and you know, in front of me, to the left, to the right, above and below. And that, what that does is it kind of establishes a zone of relevance. You know, what is actually within reach, you know, literally within reach. And that's important for attention because the whole idea of attention is that you select some things out, you know, from everything that's available and not other things. But when you're encountering the world through, you know, representations, you know, like on a computer screen where you can take a virtual tour of the Forbidden City in Beijing or of, you know, these underwater caverns, everything is lumped into a kind of distancelessness that there doesn't seem to be any non-arbitrary basis on which to say, you know, this and that and not that pertains to me. So in that condition, I think it's very hard to compose a coherent life on the basis sort of infinite options, infinite choice. Not least because, you know, whatever's going on in your immediate environment with the people that you actually share your life with is likely to not be as amusing as whatever's going on, you know, on the internet. So again, it's this feeling of subject to centrifugal forces that kind of pulls apart.
Yeah. And there's a lot to unpack there, but so you started off talking about, you know, there's this notion today that we have unlimited choices, which makes us free, but you argue that actually it can actually stifle us because we become overwhelmed with the amount of choices. And this is sort of the crux of the problem of attention. And you make the interesting case, like you said, I mean, things have gotten really changed a lot in the past 20 years with the advent of the internet and smart devices where you're constantly connected to a virtual world. But you argue that this attention problem we have originated, you know, 200-300 years ago, you could say, with the Enlightenment. I know there's a lot to unpack there, but how did the Enlightenment thinking lead to this problem of attention mm-hmm. that we have today?
Well, really at the heart of it is a set of ideas that emerged, you know, back in the 1600s about how we make contact with the world, how we grasp the world. And the big idea was that we do so only through our internal mental representations of the world. In other words, you can't really make contact with the things themselves, but you construct some picture in your head, and it's always through that kind of mediating representation that we encounter the world. Now, there's good reasons to think that this is a more or less completely bogus view of how we grasp reality. And I say that based on more recent philosophy and cognitive science. But the weird thing is that life has come to imitate theory, so that, you know, in the 21st century, sure enough, we increasingly encounter the world through these representations. So as I kind of hinted at before, I think that's the basic reason why we feel a kind of a lack of limit on our mental lives that has the effect of kind of dissipating our mental energies. Because if you're sort of bodily way of being in the world isn't providing a frame of orientation, then there's literally no limit to what you can preoccupy yourself with.
Right, and that can be just psychologically exhausting.
Yeah, totally. And it's also, I mean, we're subject to this feeling like I'm missing out, or I'm not completely optimizing my experience. I could be, you know, there's something more awesome going on in some corner I need to investigate. And that's connected, I think, to this feeling of individualism, where it's really up to everybody to kind of make themselves, you know, into their fullest self. There's a kind of existential heroism where you feel radically responsible for yourself. You know, once upon a time we had, you know, you might have had a hereditary occupation. You might have been born into some rigid social system where the range of kind of possibilities for you were quite constrained. Of course, that's bad in all kinds of ways. But what it meant is that, I think the experience of failure goes much deeper for us, precisely because we feel like if your life isn't everything you want it to be, it's on you, because we have so much freedom. And I think that leads to a lot of anxiety and depression.
Right. Even de Tocqueville, right? Is that how you say his name? the French guy. Like, he noticed that in Americans, like, they were, had a lot of freedom, but like, they were like some of the most miserable people at the same time.
Yeah. And one thing, Tocqueville's great. He pointed out that Americans, we have this, idea that everyone has to stand on their own two feet and reject any kind of example or custom, any kind of social authority. He's writing, this is back in the 1830s, and this was already true of America. And he says that this has a strange effect because we actually sense correctly that we're not really competent to judge everything for ourselves. And yet we have this kind of cultural imperative to do so, and it makes us anxious. So what we do is we look around to see what everyone else thinks, our contemporaries. So there's sort of paradoxical way in which the rugged individualist turns out to be a conformist. So in other words, we look to our contemporaries rather than to some inherited tradition or some, you know, other forms of social authority.
So going back to this idea that we're agnostic about our attention, like we don't have if we want to use like Aristotelian terms, we don't have a telos, like an end for our attention. Mm-hmm. I think you argue in the book that this originated in the Enlightenment too. So there's this idea that, you know, personal autonomy, freedom is the thing that's the most important. And as a result, like, you can't impose your beliefs on other people so that they, or your preferences on other people, because that would rob them of their freedom. And that sounds great on theory. It's like, oh yeah, everyone gets to do their own thing. But you make the case that it actually leads to sort of this blandness and flattening.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's everything you just said. If you wanted to give a name to it, you could name it subjectivism. This idea that what makes something right or good or beautiful is how I feel about it, and that all of these judgments are radically private. It's like an itch, you know, no one else can feel your itch or your pain, which means that there's a kind of, they're incommunicable in a way. We can't really enter into a shared judgment about things. And one thing that does, I think it makes us retreat ever further into ourselves. And there's a kind of timidity about disputing with one another in a kind of rational way. Instead, what we find these days is people forming these self-selecting enclaves online, right? Where we affirm one another and form these kind of micro subcultures. And you see this in politics too, where it's increasingly kind of self-reinforcing echo chambers. And the very idea of a shared truth, a shared world that we can kind of talk rationally about seems to have been eroded a little bit.
Right, right. And then it makes the world sort of bland. Like, when we do interact with others who don't share our interests, we have to keep things very neutral. I mean, you gave the example of the music at the gym where there was playing, you know, some sort of weird, you know, bland emo music was being piped in. And like, you went to the kid at the counter and said, play anything. I'm sure whatever you listen to is better than this garbage. And the kid was just like, no, I can't do that.
Yeah. It was interesting. What he said was, I wouldn't want to impose my choice on anyone. And, you know, that sounds admirable in a way. But what it meant is that he had this kind of automatic deference to the Muzak selected by some, you know, institutional Muzak provider. And so there's a weird way in which this sort of liberal notion of always respecting the majority can turn very easily into just conceding the whole field to whatever commercial forces are kind of the most energetic in taking over our public spaces. And I contrast that with when I was 13, lifting weights in the YMCA in Berkeley, where there'd be a little boom box on the floor. And, you know, people could fight over it, you know, to put their music on. Now, of course, you know, the guys who dominated the weight room were these huge, you know, sort of lineman guys who would squat like 600 pounds. So as a scrawny little white guy, obviously I wasn't going to be challenging anybody for the boom box. But I really preferred that because the source of the music was right there. It was accessible. And there's a kind of hierarchy in the weight room. It was, you know, clear to everybody. And somehow with my current experience in the gym with the Muzak, it's like it lays this kind of blank, suffocating blanket of, I don't know, lameness over the whole thing. And everyone then, of course, plugs in their earbuds because they don't want to hear the Muzak. And then you can't get a spot because you have to, like, force someone to take their earbuds out. So it just... I just miss the kind of more, slightly more edgy environment of a gym where it's there's more interaction,
right?
And there was more hierarchy,
right? So people were outside of, they had to like engage with the outside. They weren't in, you know, they weren't inside their head, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it, I think it's, you make an interesting argument too. So, you know, this idea that we have. There's an illusion that we have freedom and autonomy. We can go online and we can order shoes however we want them. We can have it delivered right to our door in 2 days, thanks to Amazon Prime. And it seems like technology is making our world more frictionless. But how is it, why is it that this frictionlessness that we're trying to achieve with, you know, what people are trying to achieve in Silicon Valley, how does that actually deter us from actually becoming an individual and actually experiencing real agency and autonomy? I mean, your example of like the Mickey Mouse clubhouse.
Yeah.
Like my kids are like, I got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. And so I've seen that show and I've hated it. I've just thought, this sucks. This is terrible. But you use that as an example of sort of like there's a sense of choice, but you really don't have a choice.
Yeah, if you watch, if you have kids, it means you end up watching a fair bit of children's television, and it's pretty horrifying. But it's hard to put your finger on what's wrong. I mean, everything is so nice, and that's partly the problem. So, you know, in the book, I contrast the old Disney cartoons with the current ones. So, in the old ones from whatever 50 years ago or something, you know, it's all about slapstick violence. Material reality is constantly thwarting and frustrating people and injuring them. And it's funny. I mean, it's funny to watch someone get slapped by an grandfather clock or, you know, retractable blinds that suddenly, you know, pull you up and around into the mechanism. So contrast that with the current iteration, where it's got all the same characters, but it's the world depicted is full of all this amazing technology that always works perfectly, and there's no moment of frustration that's allowed to arise. And so when there is, you know, some kind of difficulty that the character faces in the story, they say these magic words. I think it's Miska, Muska, something, something.
Yeah, or like, hey, Toodles is the other thing.
Yeah, right. And then, hey, Toodles. So when you say that, it makes this, this thing, I guess it's called Toodles, that condenses out of the cloud. And it's this computer-like thing. And it presents a menu of four options, four solutions for whatever problem you have. So then your task is to simply choose one of these solutions. Now, in every episode, there are four problems that arise. So you're guaranteed that one of these solutions is going to be the one. And so it's not just not funny. It's somehow the opposite of funny. And if the old cartoons were kind of depicting a certain kind of psychological reality, the new ones seem to be not concerned with depicting reality so much as adjusting kids to, to ask for help, don't give in to frustration, pick one of the solutions that's offered to you. So it's just super creepy in the way that it seems to be educating kids into a kind of passivity and dependence. This menu of options and choices, I think, makes us more pliable to whoever is creating these little choice architectures. So I put that in a chapter with the title of Virtual Reality as Moral Ideal. The idea is that there's a kind of creeping substitution of virtual reality for actual reality.
Right. And I mean, so what this does, I mean, like you said, it puts us in our head. It makes us think that some magic thing will come down and solve our problems for us without any friction. We don't have to deal with annoying customer service. We don't have to deal with stuff not working. And if something doesn't work, there will be options for us to pick from. But as you said, like that giving us those options, it gives us the appearance of autonomy, but like you really don't have it because you have to choose one of those options.
Well, the word I like is agency.
Agency.
I'm trying to shift our concern from autonomy to agency. Okay. So, with this world depicted in the contemporary Disney cartoons is one where you don't need any skill whatsoever. I mean, you choose something, but you don't have any idea how your choice is actually realized in the world. I think skill only develops in an environment where you're challenged, where you have to engage directly with, material reality that isn't sort of geared to please you. So in a world where everything is frictionless, it means you never develop skill, which means you're then dependent on whoever's arranging things for you. And that really gets to, the big idea of the book, The World Beyond Your Head, which is that it's through skilled practices that we can kind of reclaim a certain way of being in the world more directly. So I present these case studies of short order cooks, motorcycle racers, hockey players, people who build musical instruments. And these establish what I call ecologies of attention, where your perception is kind of tuned to the particular features of your environment that show up for you kind of through the lens of the activity, and extraneous information is just kind of dampened or disappears, and you get into that state of total absorption that can be really, really pleasing.
Yeah, and what you say, what these skills do, or getting involved in a skilled practice, it forces you out of your head. You have to deal with the world as it is, and not how you wish it were. Magic Mickey Mouse Club land. But then also you argue that skilled practices usually have these traditions or sort of hierarchy, as you talked about earlier, that, on the one hand, it seems like, oh, wow, that's stifling. But you argue actually, no, it actually is the way you can have agency and express your individuality.
Yeah. I mean, to begin with, just, physical stuff, to get good at playing the guitar, you have to submit to the mechanical, contingencies of the instrument. You have to practice scales endlessly. Similarly, learning a foreign language is just a lot to learn. It provides a kind of authoritative structure within which you develop your powers of expression. So I think it's true in general that real agency only arises in the context of submission to things you have not made yourself. And the term submission and authority, those are really jarring to the modern ear. Especially if it involves other people. I mean, it's one thing to submit to a guitar, but if there's other people involved in it, then we really get our hackles up. The final chapter of the book, I'm talking about this shop where they're building Baroque pipe organs. So they've inherited these forms of the Baroque pipe organ. They're hundreds of years old. And what was really interesting about it to me is that they're engaged in this, it isn't simply a kind of loving antiquarianism where they're, reproducing these static forms that have come down to them. It's more like they're engaged in this quarrel with the organ builders of the past. And it's a quarrel about how to best realize, the musical potential of the pipe organ. So it's a conversation, and it moves along, and it kind of has a point. And one reason it was so fascinating is that, well, to begin with, they're building their pipe organs to last 400 years. I mean, they're literally, that's their time frame. They're putting these in churches, in music halls. That alone shows you they're working on a very different time scale than most of the economy. And there's this interplay between being oriented toward the past and being oriented toward the future. And it means that the individual craftspeople working there, and there was maybe 20 or 30 people working there, their development and skill and understanding, they see as part of this much longer historical arc, which is the history of their trade. And it's this kind of living tradition that they situate themselves in. And it really seems to kind of give a meaning to their work and a kind of narrative coherence to their lives that I found really quite amazing. And one thing my observations there really did was complicate this idea of the spirit of technology versus the spirit of kind of preservation. We often think that technology is, just kind of vandalizes the things that we care about, or that it's some kind of saving force that will, make the world into utopia or something. But here it was this kind of interplay of they're constantly innovating, they're trying new materials, but it's with a view to kind of keeping alive this story arc they're part of. And I just thought it was really it cut so much against the image we have of the innovator as, just gestating in a California garage someplace and then emerging like Moses with his, new app or whatever it may be, which is this kind of totally isolated moment, disconnected to the past and the future. And so it was interesting for that reason.
Right. And so, the gist is by embedding themselves in this tradition and in this community, very small community of organ restorers and builders, it gave them a reference to which their changes meant something, right? So if they decided to use this material for the stop, they were being true to it, but at the same time, it allowed them to innovate as well. It gave them reference for their innovation, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and it's all these sort of overlapping lineages of apprenticeship is what makes up this community. And, as a beginning organ maker, you have to just kind of do things the way your teacher shows you without fully understanding the reasons for it. You learn by imitation. And there's a kind of mentorship that happens. And, in our You know, in America, apprenticeship is often criticized for being too narrow in education. It's often said that what the economy demands is workers who are flexible, almost, you know, that they shouldn't be burdened with any particular set of skills or knowledge because you have to be ready to reinvent yourself at any time. But when you go deep into some particular art or skill, it trains your powers of concentration and perception. You become more discerning about these particular objects, you know, in this case, pipe organs. And if all goes well, you begin to care viscerally about quality, usually because you've been initiated into a kind of ethic of caring about what you're doing by the example of some particular person, some mentor who embodies that spirit of craftsmanship. So I guess my point then is that this kind of technical training that was certainly narrow in its immediate application can be understood as part of education in the broadest sense, that is, intellectual and moral formation. So there, I think, there's a larger point to be made about kind of hands-on training for young people.
Yeah, this reminds me of a conversation I had with a lady named Susan Wise Bauer. I think she lives in Virginia. I know she wrote a book called The Classical Education You Never Had. And she makes a similar argument, you know, that today in education in our schools, like we think telling kids to memorize, you know, rote information, right? Like dates and like, who are the characters and, you know, books, like we shouldn't do that because like in today's economy, they need to know how to think and like, you know, be flexible. But she says like, when you skip over that sort of the very basics, and get people to developing opinions, that's what she says. Kids are taught to develop opinions. They don't have anything to build their opinion on. So opinion is sort of shaky.
Yeah. I think if you don't have actual knowledge, then it's very hard to think because then you're just kind of moving around vague abstractions. I mean, yeah, I think that's really true.
Yeah. So Matthew, it's been a really fascinating conversation. We've really like scraped the surface of it, but I'm curious. I mean, so what's the takeaway for us guys who, you know, that maybe we're not going to start a Baroque organ shop or become a, you know, custom motorcycle guy. But I mean, what's the takeaway for us? Is it to get in touch with the real as much as possible and stay away from representations?
You know, I think any activity that brings you into kind of cooperation and conflict with other people kind of gets at a lot of this. So just, you know, playing sports, playing music with other people, you know, cooking a meal. I mean, this is just very obvious kind of advice that won't come as a shock to anybody. There's nothing new here, but it does seem like the real satisfactions we get in life are when we're, doing stuff that's real in the sense that, it's not some manufactured experience that's been designed around you. Simply to gratify your need for certain kinds of stimulation. So, it seems like we need some kind of big grand point here to end.
It makes sense. It's just it's a nice reminder for people. And like this, you know, reading it not only has helped me, but it's made me think about how I parent and like being cognizant of like, okay, am I letting my kids spend too much time on the iPad, even though he only gets like a limited amount of time. Like maybe I need to shut that off and get him outside and experience stuff that frustrates him.
Yeah.
I guess the other takeaway is don't let your kids watch Mickey Mouse Clubhouse.
Yeah. Get some old Three Stooges or, those old violent Roadrunner cartoons. because for one thing, they're actually funny.
They are funny, but it also teaches you something. It's teaching them something that the world isn't always going to save you.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Well,
Matthew,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say,
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, where can people learn more about your work?
Well, I've got a website. It's MatthewBCrawford.com. No period after the B as in boy. And I've got links to some of my shorter writings. People can get a little taste if they want. And then from there, there's a link to my shop. If you're looking for custom motorcycle parts, hit me up.
Cool. Well, Matthew Crawford, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brett.
My guest today was Matthew Crawford. He's the author of the book, The World Beyond Your Head. You can find that on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find more information about Matthew's work at MatthewBCrawford.com. And check out our show notes at AOM.IS/Crawford for links to resources where you can delve deeper in the topics we discussed today on the show. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this show and have got something out of it, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher, as that helps promote the show. As always, I appreciate your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.